Welcome to The Debate. Right now, millions of patients are trapped in bodies that are, well, fundamentally suffocating. And modern medicine is trying to cure them by treating their organs as if they were disconnected islands.
Right. If you're listening to this and wondering why your doctor might be treating your severe fatigue, your brain fog, and your racing heart as three entirely separate problems?
As totally isolated issues.
Exactly. You are at the center of the most profound crisis in modern biomedical science.
And, I mean, it is a crisis of categorization as much as it is a crisis of treatment. When the human organism begins to fail at a systemic level, it practically disappears into specialized departments. You know, the cardiologist looks at the heart, the neurologist looks at the nervous system.
The immunologist looks at the immune response.
Yeah.
And in doing so, the systemic continuity of the disease is frequently dismissed as mere coincidence, simply because we don't have a single billing code or a diagnostic bucket to put it in.
That is the exact focal point of our discussion today. We are looking at Dr. Bechara Saheli's April 2026 white paper, Toward a Coherence Physiology. This paper proposes a radical ground-up shift in how biomedicine approaches chronic multi-system illness.
It really does.
Dr. Saheli argues that we need to abandon our fragmented organ-by-organ approach, what the paper terms the organ assemblage model. Instead, he proposes we must understand the body as a nested continuum of dynamically coupled processes.
The central question we are exploring today is whether this coherence physiology model represents a necessary, biologically accurate paradigm shift for understanding complex diseases, or, on the flip side, if it risks something I find deeply concerning, premature totalization.
Premature totalization, right?
Yeah. We have to ask if this framework forces rigorously proven biological mechanisms to share a foundation with highly exploratory, unproven theories, creating an appealing but, well, fundamentally flawed grand unified theory of the human body.
Here is where I stand on this. I look at the current medical model, and I see a system that completely fails the reality of chronic illness. It takes a patient suffering from overlapping vascular, immunological, and metabolic collapse, and it routes them through a maze of specialists who don't even share the same diagnostic vocabulary. I argue that Saheli's integrative framework provides the exact explanatory architecture we desperately need. It maps the interconnectedness of these systems and offers a way to actually reverse, rather than just manage, multi-system disease.
I come at it from a very different angle. I read this paper and see a brilliant synthesis of some very real, rigorously established biological phenomena, which is then artificially bound to highly speculative biophysics.
Speculative?
Yes, highly speculative. My position is that by constructing this sweeping narrative, the paper risks abandoning the precise, reductionist mechanisms that actually make modern medicine effective. I mean, we cannot sacrifice diagnostic precision for the sake of a conceptually elegant, holistic metaphor.
Let's start by looking at why this conceptual elegance is actually a clinical necessity. If we look at the legacy of modern medicine, it is an absolute triumph in the realm of acute trauma and localized pathology.
Absolutely.
Right? If you rupture your appendix or you contract a severe bacterial pneumonia, the organ assemblage model works perfectly. We locate the lesion, we identify the pathogen, we intervene with overwhelming force, and we clear the issue. But that entire logic architecture collapses when faced with diffuse, environmentally contingent conditions.
Like what?
Like chronic inflammatory response syndrome or severe dysautonomia.
I mean, the traditional model absolutely struggles with diffuse syndromes. I completely agree there. But, you know, highlighting a vulnerability in the current system doesn't automatically validate a new paradigm.
Well, it validates the need for a new way of looking at the organism. The current model fails because it views the body as isolated parts that just happen to share the same skin.
That's a bit reductive, but okay.
Saheli's model maps how the body actually gets trapped in what he calls defensive lock-in. This isn't just a metaphor. It is a biological state where physical structural strain in the connective tissue, vascular degradation in the capillaries, and defensive metabolic shifts in the mitochondria all mutually reinforce one another.
Right.
A negative feedback loop.
Exactly. The body gets locked in a closed loop of physiological alarm. Without this macro-level, systems-wide view, we are just playing chemical whack-a-mole. We suppress downstream symptoms with pharmaceuticals rather than facilitating true solidogenesis.
Solidogenesis being the active biological process of returning to a state of health.
Right.
Look, I don't disagree, but treating symptoms in isolation is often a fool's errand. The paper's attempt to build an epistemic commons, a shared language where mechanobiology, immunology, and metabolism can integrate their findings, is conceptually attractive. But methodologically, it is perilous.
Perilous? How?
Well, Sacchelli explicitly outlines an evidence gradient in his paper, acknowledging that some of his points are proven facts, while others are theoretical. But in practice, the model completely blurs those lines.
I don't think it blurs them. I think it integrates them to show the whole picture. Where specifically do you see this perilous methodology?
It happens at the very foundation of his physical substrate. Take the biological mechanisms he relies on. Endothelial mechanotransduction, the process by which the inner lining of our blood vessels physically senses the shear stress of flowing blood and releases nitric oxide to dilate the vessel.
Right, a core concept.
Right, and that is a rigorously established fact. Mast cell degranulation is a rigorously established fact. But he takes these hard biological realities and anchors them to a highly inferential, heavily debated theory of physics, Gerald Pollack's interfacial water.
Okay, yes.
By labeling traditional targeted biomedicine as epistemic closure, the paper unfairly dismisses the rigorous, step-by-step reductionism required to confidently cure disease without causing unintended harm.
You might be thinking this sounds like a purely academic distinction, but let's dive into how these pieces actually fit together, starting exactly where you pointed, the material substrate itself. We have to unpack the transition from the organ assemblage to the nested continuum.
The anatomy.
For decades, anatomical science has treated fascia, you know, the vast web of connective tissue running through our bodies, and the fluid-filled spaces between ourselves as passive packing material. It was viewed as the biological bubble wrap protecting the real organs.
A view that the anatomical community has steadily corrected over the last 20 years, yes?
Corrected, but not fully operationalized in the clinic. Sahaly leverages modern connective tissue research to show that this fascial matrix is not inert. It is a body-wide mechanosensitive continuum.
Right.
It distributes physical force and biological information globally through a principle called biotensegrity. Think of the body not as a stack of building blocks, but as a complex spider web.
Okay, a spider web.
If you pull on one corner of a spider web, the tension changes across the entire structure immediately. Because the human organism is a continuous tensegrity structure, local mechanical strains don't stay local. A restriction in the fascial matrix of your shoulder changes the tension, the sensory input, and even the microfluidic flow system-wide.
Meaning the organism is structurally integrated long before it is functionally partitioned into organs.
Exactly.
The concept of biotensegrity is fascinating, and we certainly know connective tissue has active sensory innervation. But does rebranding the human body as a nested continuum actually offer new clinical utility? We are talking about actionable medicine here.
It is deeply actionable.
But if a patient presents with severe ischemic heart disease, treating them as a nested continuum doesn't change the fact that they need a cardiologist to address the specific localized atherosclerotic plaques in their coronary arteries.
It absolutely changes the clinical utility when the disease isn't a localized plaque. Think of it this way. If your car has a busted radiator, you swap the hardware. That's acute medicine.
Right.
But what if the entire network of the car is locked down because the central computer detects a systemic voltage failure? You can't fix a distributed regulatory failure by endlessly swapping out individual hardware parts. Look at panvascular microvascular dysfunction.
The capillaries.
Yes. This is a condition where the retina, the kidney, and the heart all begin to fail in parallel. Treating those organs separately ignores the fundamental reality that the entire organism is experiencing a failure of its distributed exchange intelligence.
Hmm.
The endothelium, the massive, body-wide sensory organ lining our blood vessels, is fundamentally failing to interpret flow and regulate permeability across the entire network.
I mean, the panvascular model isn't revolutionary on its own, We already know that microvascular dysfunction is a pan-organ process. The breakdown of the endothelial glycocalyx.
The gel layer.
Right, that microscopic, hair-like gel layer inside our blood vessels that senses blood flow and protects the vessel wall. That is a major, well-documented driver of systemic disease. If that gel degrades, the whole vascular system leaks. But here is the critical pivot where the paper loses me.
Where?
Sahali doesn't stop at established vascular biology. He takes this network-wide communication and insists it relies on a highly controversial physical medium to function.
You are referring to interfacial water. And if we want to truly understand how a network-wide physical tension actually communicates with a biological cell, we have to talk about the physical medium facilitating it.
We do. And this is exactly where the epistemic hygiene of the paper falls apart. Sahali relies entirely on Gerald Pollack's concept of the fourth phase of water,
which is crucial to his point.
For those listening, this standard view of water in the body is bulk water, just H2O molecules tumbling around randomly, acting as a passive solvent. Pollack's claim is that when water sits against a hydrophilic or water-loving surface like collagen fibers or the inside of a cell membrane, it stops being random. It forms a highly ordered crystal-like lattice.
Exactly. An organized structure that physically excludes dissolved solutes, which Pollack calls an exclusion zone.
Yes, and crucially, Pollack claims this structured water generates a massive separation of electrical charge, effectively acting like a battery. Now, I will concede that living tissues are incredibly crowded environments filled with hydrophilic surfaces.
Very crowded.
But elevating interface-dependent hydration states to be the foundational biophysical substrate of human disease is an enormous, precarious leap. You are taking fascinating yet heavily debated in vitro physics experiments conducted in a laboratory beaker and claiming this is the primary mechanism by which chronic fatigue syndrome propagates through the human fascial network.
I don't think it's just...
It is an extrapolation that outpaces the evidence by miles.
I see why that leap makes a strict reductionist nervous, but I'm not convinced it's an extrapolation we can afford to ignore. Sahali is incredibly transparent. He explicitly labels interfacial water as providing substrate-level explanatory leverage.
Explanatory leverage, sure.
He isn't claiming he has mapped every molecule in vivo. He is pointing out that treating the water inside us as a passive background liquid is a massive physiological blind spot. We have to explain how mechanical pressure becomes biological intelligence.
We explain it through known mechanosensitive ion channels like Piaggio-1, which physically open when the cell membrane is stretched. We don't need crystalline water batteries to explain touch.
But how does that stretch reach the membrane in the first place? Force doesn't move through a vacuum. It moves through a hydrated, responsive tissue matrix. If interfacial water structures itself against proteins and creates a charge separation, it acts as a transducer.
A transducer?
Yes. When physical tension changes in the fascia, the crystalline structure of the water compresses. That compression alters the electrical charge, which instantly alters the shape and function of the proteins it surrounds.
Okay.
The hydration state at the tissue interface is the literal translation layer between mechanical, physical pressure and biochemical signaling. If that water loses its structure due to oxidative stress, the body literally loses its ability to accurately interpret force and flow.
Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that interface-dependent hydration plays this massive translatory role in mechanotransduction. How does this theoretical biophysics actually translate to patient pathology?
What do you mean?
How do we get from ordered water molecules losing their charge to a patient who is trapped in a dark room, unable to stand up without their heart rate spiking to 150 beats per minute? This transition forces us to look at the paper's proposed clinical mechanism, the cell danger response.
And this is where the continuum becomes profoundly actionable. To bridge the gap from physical tension to clinical exhaustion, we have to look at the mitochondria.
Right.
For decades, textbooks have called them the powerhouses of the cell, just mindless little factories churning out ATP for energy. But building on the groundbreaking work of researchers like Robert Naviax and Martin Picard, Sahali's model positions mitochondria as the executive regulators of the organism.
They are environmental sensors that continuously alter cellular priorities based on available resources and threats.
Precisely. They are constantly interpreting threat signals. And a threat isn't just a virus. It can be physical toxins, mechanical tissue strain, or even psychosocial stress.
Right. Picard's work on mitochondrial psychobiology.
Exactly. Which demonstrates exactly how lived psychological trauma is transduced into a biological metabolic state. When mitochondria sense an overwhelming threat, they initiate the cell danger response. Think of the cell like a prosperous city. Normally, it uses its resources to build, export goods, or in this case, ATP energy.
Mm-hmm.
But when the city comes under siege, the government stops exporting goods, it diverts all available energy to reinforce the city walls and manufacture weapons.
In biological terms, the cell shifts from a state of healthy metabolism and growth into a hypometabolic defense mode. It weaponizes oxygen to create reactive oxygen species, and it uses ATP not as internal fuel, but ejects it outside the cell.
Yes, purinergic signaling. The cell literally pumps ATP into the extracellular space, where it acts as a chemical distress flare, warning neighboring cells that an invader is present,
causing profound fatigue.
This is why the patient has no energy. Their cells aren't broken. They are actively spending their energy budget on cellular defense instead of organismal movement. The patient is trapped in defensive lock-in, and this brings us to the core clinical philosophy of the paper, Wu Wei Medicine.
The concept of non-coercive action.
Exactly. If a patient is trapped in this lock-in, their cells are bankrupt. They do not have the energetic currency to heal. You cannot force a starving, besieged city to build a new hospital.
Right.
Wu Wei Medicine recognizes this thermodynamic reality. You cannot just aggressively bombard the body with pharmaceuticals to suppress downstream symptoms. You have to align with the body's natural energetic sequence. You must remove the environmental resistance, calm the tissue-resident mast cells that are acting as hypervigilant border guards, and allow the mitochondria to feel safe enough to lower the drawbridge.
And only then can cellogenesis resume.
Only then?
I appreciate the thermodynamic elegance of that metaphor. But this is exactly where the model risks causing clinical harm in the real world.
Harm? How so?
Wu Wei Medicine sounds beautiful, but the assertion that we should avoid forceful override of downstream outputs, which is really just a pejorative way of saying targeted pharmacological intervention, is profoundly dangerous when dealing with severe pathology.
Why dangerous? Sahaly explicitly states this doesn't preclude acute interventions when life is on the line?
Because biological feedback loops do not just passively dissolve when you remove the initial stressor. They become pathologically entrenched. A forceful course of intervention is very often the only thing that breaks a destructive biological loop.
But you're ignoring the...
Let's talk about those mast cells you mentioned. Mast cells are packed with histamine and inflammatory cytokines. If a patient is trapped in a severe chronic inflammatory loop, their mast cells are constantly degranulating, destroying the surrounding endothelial glycocalyx, and flooding the local tissue with inflammatory noise.
Which further alarms the mitochondria, locking the loop.
Exactly. And in that scenario, waiting for the body to organically exit defensive lock-in by gently adjusting their substrate hydration or removing psychosocial stress is vastly insufficient. You are watching the neighborhood burn.
That's a dramatic way to frame it.
It's the reality of severe inflammation. Sometimes you absolutely need a coercive pharmaceutical force, a targeted biologic, a steroid, or an aggressive mast cell stabilizer to forcefully halt the degranulation. The idea that we can coax deeply entrenched biological dysregulation back into coherence purely by removing unnecessary resistance vastly underestimates how self-sustaining these disease states become.
I don't think it underestimates it at all. I think it recontextualizes the cost of that pharmaceutical force. Let's look at the energy resistance principle detailed in the text.
Okay.
Sahaly argues that a biological system in chronic illness has become thermodynamically resistant. If you apply coercive pharmaceutical force to a system that is energetically locked down, you are forcing a biological action that the cell literally cannot afford. What happens? You don't cure the system, you just create massive side effects, or the pathology simply shifts to another organ system.
But you stop the immediate tissue destruction.
You buy the organism time.
You buy time, but you sacrifice the possibility of actual cell eugenesis. To achieve real recovery, you must address the substrate and the exchange intelligence first. You have to repair the endothelial glycocalyx so that the blood vessels can properly dilate. You have to restore the flow of fluid through the fascial interstitium.
I agree, flow is important.
If the patient's microcirculation is collapsed and their tissues are literally suffocating in their own metabolic waste because the capillaries can't clear it, giving them a targeted immune suppressant is just turning off the fire alarm while the smoke continues to build. Wu-Wei medicine doesn't mean doing nothing.
Then what does it mean in practice?
It means aggressively fixing the flow so that the body's intrinsic evolutionary repair mechanisms actually have the oxygen, the nutrients, and the energetic currency to do their job.
Let me be clear. I do not dispute that restoring microvascular flow is paramount. If the capillaries aren't perfusing the tissue dies. My critique is not with the vascular biology.
Then what is it?
My critique is that packaging this as a grand unified coherence physiology requires us to accept a massive evidentiary gradient as a single flat truth. You are taking the incredibly rigorous, vital science of microvascular dysfunction and you are marrying it to interfacial water physics and non-coercive Taoist philosophy.
It is not a philosophy. It is a biological framework based on the limits of cellular thermodynamics.
But it operates as a philosophical umbrella that dictates clinical choices. And my deepest concern here is epistemic hygiene. In our pursuit of an epistemic commons where the immunologist and the mechanobiologist can finally speak the same language, we cannot lower our standards of evidence.
I agree we shouldn't lower standards.
We cannot abandon rigorous, molecularly targeted medicine just because systemic, holistic theories feel more intuitively comforting to patients who are suffering from deeply complex, unexplained illnesses. We owe them precision, not just a compelling narrative.
I agree that epistemic hygiene is vital, but I would argue that true intellectual hygiene requires us to recognize when our current reductionist models have utterly failed the reality in front of us. We are currently facing an epidemic of chronic, multi-system illnesses that simply do not fit into neat, single-organ boxes.
That is true.
Coherence physiology provides the desperately needed architecture to understand why. It gives us a mechanistic language to explain how a mechanical strain in the fascial matrix might trigger a local mast cell response, which in turn degrades the microvascular exchange, which ultimately locks the mitochondria into a defensive, energy-starved state. It maps the biological reality that we know exists in a living human being.
I will concede this very important point. The strict, isolated organ-by-organ model is reaching its absolute limits, particularly in the face of post-viral syndromes, dysautonomia, and chronic systemic inflammatory states.
Exactly.
Your points on the microcirculation acting as a distributed exchange intelligence are spot on. And I think the repositioning of mast cells in this paper is brilliant, treating them not just as the cells that cause seasonal allergies, but as ancient, tissue-resident sentinels, constantly negotiating the boundaries between our nervous system, our blood vessels, and the outside world. It is a profound and necessary shift in how we view the immune system.
Because they sit at the literal physical intersections of the nerves and the capillary beds. They are the local border patrol. If they are constantly alarmed by poor flow or tissue strain, the whole systemic network locks down in solidarity. We agree on the fundamental interconnected mechanisms of the failure.
We agree on the biological mechanisms of that systemic failure. Where I draw a hard line is adopting the entire nested continuum as a verified clinical paradigm when its foundational biophysical substrate relies on exploratory physics.
Fair enough.
The integration of vascular, immunological, and metabolic science is vital. But we must maintain strict boundaries on what is established science and what is an exploratory frontier, lest we lose the ability to reliably intervene when the system fails.
Dr. Sahali certainly acknowledges those gradients in his work, but he also recognizes that the millions of people suffering from these coherence failures today cannot wait another 50 years for perfectly siloed reductionist proof.
That's a difficult reality to navigate.
It is. The beauty of tortocoherence physiology is that it forces us to lift our microscopes and look at the spaces between the organs, to look at the fluids, the connective tissue, and the energetic state of the organism as a whole.
It unequivocally forces a broader, more integrated perspective. I think any clinician or researcher who reads this white paper will walk away with a profoundly deeper appreciation for the microvasculature and the mitochondrial response to environmental threat.
Absolutely.
Whether that appreciation inspires them to throw away their targeted pharmaceuticals in favor of non-coercive Wu-Wei medicine is something that remains to be seen.
And that is exactly where we must leave it for our listeners to evaluate. Does the future of treating chronic illness lie in designing increasingly precise, modular pharmaceutical interventions that target highly specific molecular pathways? Or does it lie in understanding systemic coherence, aligning with the body's natural thermodynamic and structural states to promote genuine biological recovery? There is a wealth of complexity yet to be explored within Dr. Saheli's framework.
It is, without a doubt, a debate that will define the trajectory of medical research for the next decade.
For the last century, modern medicine has operated like a technician, staring at an X-ray, searching the black void for the bright, jagged white line of a broken bone. But what coherence physiology suggests is that when it comes to the devastating reality of chronic illness, we shouldn't be looking for the broken bone at all. We need to stop staring at the islands and start understanding the pressure, the tension, and the flow of the entire living ocean that connects them.